Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to this Peak Prosperity Podcast, everybody. It is December 5th, 2017. I am your host, Chris Martinson. Today, we are going to be talking about the massive financial bubbles that currently envelop the Earth. You've heard me talking about them ever since the Crash Course was released in 2008 and on podcasts ever since. I've been writing about them since 2007 when I personally began shorting the U.S. housing bubble in earnest. More recently, I've penned pieces titled The Mother of All Bubbles and When Bubbles Burst. Truly, there's nowhere to hide anymore after so many years of coordinated global central bank action. Our guest today is someone I have followed for years and whose writings were instrumental in helping me formulate the economic portion of the Crash Course. His name is Doug Noland, and I first became acquainted with his writings and ideas when he worked for the Prudent Bear Funds, where he worked for 16 years with David Tice. In the 10 years prior to that, Doug worked as a short side trader, analyst, and portfolio manager during the great 90s bull market. If there's ever a crucible for honing one's skills, it's in locating profitable shorts in a rising market. Doug now works with David McIlvaney at McIlvaney Wealth Management. I've been on David's program a few times. He's a class act, someone I very much respect. The summary here is that Doug has 30 plus years of experience and is a great analyst and commentator of credit cycles and dynamics, which makes him one of the very best people to talk to here at the heights and possibly ends of one of the greatest credit bubbles in all of human history. Doug, welcome to the program.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for having me on, and those are very kind words. Thank you very much.
Well, you're more than welcome. Seriously, I mean every word of it. I've been following you for years, and your writing is just, it's kind of like you do for credit bubbles what John Hussman does for equity valuations for me. You put the numbers to it. You put the context. We have to know where we are historically. So, Doug, in your view, did I overdo it? Maybe engage in a little bit of, you know, podcast hyperbole when I said one of the greatest credit bubbles in all of human history?
Well, Chris, I think you referred to it as the mother of all bubbles. I refer to it as the granddaddy of all bubbles. I agree completely. The bubble, it's gone to the heart of money and credit. It's gone global. And as you mentioned, it's basically across all asset classes. So this is a deeply, deeply systemic bubble. And I fear when this bubble bursts, that's finally when we kick the can down the road as much as we can, and there will be serious problems to deal with.
Now, I want to talk about those serious problems, but just to continue setting the stage for listeners here, if I've interpreted you correctly, what we're really facing, it's not, say, a Bitcoin bubble. People are saying, you know, there's a clear exponential or hyperbolic sort of an increase there, or maybe a housing bubble, as we're seeing in Melbourne or Toronto or London, or maybe even an equity bubble, but a credit bubble. Help us understand what a credit bubble is and why these other bubbles are just sort of bublets or derivatives of the big one.
Sure. And I really dove into bubble analysis back in the early 1990s. And I was convinced that finance was fundamentally changing with the advent of asset-backed securities, mortgage-backed securities, you know, the GSEs, Wall Street finance, all the derivatives. We were basically changing the way finance was created. The old model where you had banks creating credit and bank credit was limited by reserve and capital requirements, that was thrown out the window. We now had unfettered credit growth through market-based credit. And I started writing my blog at the end of the 1990s. I was convinced that once the central banks realized that this was this new experiment in finance, that they would recognize that it was unstable and they would move to rein things in. Well, the way it ended up is that experiment in finance basically failed. It failed first in the early with the collapse of the technology bubble, And then with the collapse in the mortgage finance bubble, that model of new finance basically failed. So what the Federal Reserve did and then central banks did is they started an experiment in central banking with all, you know, with the collapse of interest rates and all the quantitative easing, buying all the debt, basically creating new money, that experiment in central banking was trying to stabilize this unstable finance. And as we've seen, especially over the last 8 or 9 years, that's ended up with central banks creating, what, $10, $12, $14 trillion worth of new money. Interest rates have stayed low. And that's what has really led to this global bubble. It's just a complete mispricing of finance. Back during the mortgage finance bubble period, I used to talk about the moneyness of credit, where basically we were transforming, Wall Street was transforming all of this risky credit into perceived safe money-like AAA rated securities. And that was through, you know, the GSE guarantees and the implied guarantee by the government. And what I've said over the last 8 or 9 years, we've moved this, instead of the moneyness of credit, it's called the moneyness of risk assets, where basically central banks are backstopping liquidity and basically the prices of risk assets. They've collapsed interest rates. They've forced savers out of savings into the risk markets. And that's how it's become deeply systemic. And that's how these pricing distortions, these really significant market misperceptions are throughout the markets, you know, at home and abroad. Basically, everyone believes that you can buy higher yield junk debt or structured finance, and the Fed will ensure the markets are liquid. Why not write market insurance? Why not write derivatives, sell derivatives, take those proceeds, like writing flood insurance during a drought? So that's been part of this whole, you know, short volatility trade. And that's created all this cheap insurance. So if the market insurance is so cheap, why not go out and take a lot of risk, put on leverage, run these aggressive strategies if you know it's so easy to go out and hedge yourself? So unfortunately, you know, again, the granddaddy of all bubbles, I can't believe it's gone on this long. And in fact, you know, if you recall back, Chris, in 2011, the Fed came out with an exit strategy. And I know I titled one of my bulletins at the time, No Exit, because I didn't believe they would actually wind down that balance sheet that they bloated during the crisis. But back in 2011, when they were talking exit strategy, I didn't realize they were going to double their balance sheet again to $4.5 trillion over a few years. So anyway, I think this has just gotten away from them. It's gotten away from global central bankers. It's certainly gotten away from the Chinese with their credit bubble. And basically a bubble, this is a long-winded answer to your question, a bubble is a self-reinforcing inflation that in the end is unsustainable. And that's the deal with credit bubbles. As long as you continue to create more credit, they look sustainable. But at the end of the day, that credit is suspect, especially late in the cycle. It's very risky credit. And if the market turns on that credit, as we saw in 2008, then the bubble is extremely vulnerable.
Now, how far back, Doug, do we have to rewind this to figure out where the mistakes came? You know, Einstein, to paraphrase, said that compounding is one of the most powerful forces in the universe. Well, in my analysis, and I think yours as well, that the central banks, beginning under Greenspan in the United States, started compounding errors. And one of the prime errors that I can detect is when we suddenly convinced ourselves that we could grow our credit markets at twice the rate that our GDP, or gross domestic product, was growing, which I'll use as a proxy for income. Not a good one, as we all know, because a hurricane like Harvey can come and ruin a city for a while, and that counts as a positive in that model. GDP does a very poor job by mistaking income and balance sheet actions. But at any rate, leaving that aside, let's just say, to me, that was the ultimate, almost cartoonish error that was made, was falling into this thought idea that we could compound our debts at twice the rate of income. And by my measures, you know, up through 2000 itself, and it's only accelerated since then, we were compounding our debts, our total credit market debt. For people listening, total credit market debt, that's auto loans, student loans, all household debt, corporate debt, federal, state, local, all that. So everything you can call debt not liabilities. This isn't unfunded or underfunded pensions, entitlements, just debt. Those were compounding at almost 9%, 8.9% per year, starting in 1970 and then carrying through to 2000. That's a 40-year run. Meanwhile, GDP, even nominal GDP, was compounding at about 6%. Our real GDP was compounding at about 4% during that period, or, you know, roughly half. Just to me, I don't know if it needs to be any more complex than that. That's just a grade school error, isn't it?
Yeah, and this gets back to, you know, I call it, and it was called this historically, is inflationism. There's this view at the Fed that as long as you continue to have the 2 to 3% inflation, that you can always inflate your way out of debt problems. So I think their view, they got very complacent, that they weren't fearful of these compounding, you know, periods of compounding debt, because they thought, okay, if there's stress in the system, then we can just increase the inflation rate and grow our way out of trouble. And that's just a, you know, a deep flaw of the whole notion of inflationism. And that definitely, you know, I mean, we can go all the way back to the 70s and, you know, taking the dollar off the gold standard, you know, we can do all of that. But I think the biggest mistake started after the stock market crash in 87. That's when we started to see, you know, the growth in portfolio insurance and junk bonds and all these more sophisticated Wall Street instruments, derivative markets, et cetera. And instead of the Fed moving at that point and saying, okay, this finance is unstable, after the crash in 87, Greenspan basically assured the market that they would stay liquid, that they would reliquify the market. And that changed market dynamics profoundly. Of all of a sudden, the market realizes, okay, the Fed's there to backstop liquidity, then you're off and running. And then after that, we saw the excesses, huge credit growth in the late 80s, the Milken era, Boesky, you know, the M&A. And it's almost hilarious now to think back, because the 80s were referred to at the time as the decade of greed. Mm-hmm. You know, little did we know what was going to unfold after that. But that really set in motion that the Fed would accommodate excesses. And if there were any problems in the system, then the Fed would come out and bail the system out again. And we saw that in early 1990s after the excesses of the late 80s. You had the bursting bubble, and then the Greenspan Fed at that point manipulated the yield curve, collapsed short-term rates, provided this big margin for banks to recapitalize themselves after, you know, the coastal real estate collapses. Well, that just invited hedge funds to come in and leverage, borrow short, and leverage long and longer dated, higher yielding securities. And that set off the next bubble, right? And then the bond bubble burst in 1994. And then you have Fannie and Freddie come into the market and act almost like central banks and aggressively expand their balance sheets and reliquify the hedge funds that were in trouble. And then you have the Mexican bailout, and that fed the bubbles in Southeast Asia, and then they burst, and then the Russian bubble collapsed in 1998, and then there were more bailouts in the Committee to Save the World, and each time the bubble was bigger, and then, you know, the government involvement in the rescue or the bailouts were even bigger. So it just conditioned the markets that, you know, you can expand credit as much as you want and leverage as much as you want, and the Fed's there to make sure the markets are liquid. And, you know, it's just a very dangerous dynamic. It's not the way capitalism is supposed to operate. And that's kind of how we got to where we are today. It's, you know, it started decades ago. And that's part of the issue also, Chris. Today, everybody thinks this is normal. They think 2008 was the 100-year flood. We don't have to worry about that again. And if there is an issue that comes up, global central bankers are on the case. And that's always, I think, the kiss of death for a market. That's what ensures the bubble gets out of control, is this view that, you know, somebody out there, the central banks, won't allow a crisis. You know, we heard that, you know, Russia, the West will never allow a collapse in Russia. Washington will never allow a housing bust, right? And that market misperception always leads to the excesses that ensure at the end of the day you have a very dangerous bubble.
So there are several things you need to have a bubble. That misperception is one. I do like to, maybe it's too early for the postmortem, but it annoys me that Greenspan is skating off into history as a maestro in some people's eyes when I viewed him as somebody who completely misinterpreted the role of derivatives. He somehow thought that they had space launched risk into outer space, never to be seen again. They achieved escape velocity, but instead, it's sort of like there's a second law of thermodynamics for risk, which is it's neither created nor destroyed. You know, you can just transfer it for a little while, but it still sits there. And of course, it came roaring back with the housing bubble. But here at this point in time, I think, you know, the biggest error has to be that everywhere and always, listen, bubbles can form in a variety of things, tulips, railroads, swampland, houses, and people look at those and say, oh, you know, those were kind of unique things to those individual things that the bubbles were focused on. But in truth, there's no bubble I can find, and maybe you have different data, that could have happened without credit being freely available. That I can't find a bubble that existed purely just because people were using, you know, hard-earned savings or actual formed capital. It required credit. And so, you know, as we look at this large sweep of history and we say, wow, these guys had this idea, and gals now, that we could just continually increase credit forever into infinity. That's just our model. This is how it's going to work. This really feels like a really extremely defective idea to me. And the astonishing thing to me was it clearly broke apart in 1998. It broke apart again in 2000. It broke again in 2007. And here we are repeating literally the same mistakes, except this time everybody's invested their hope in the idea that the relatively small number of people appointed to sit on around the mahogany tables at various central banks, that these people are going to get it right this time. Don't worry. Nothing bad can happen anymore.
Yeah, and bubbles are very, I mean, they're fascinating dynamics. And as you said, there has to be a credit component. Under every bubble, there's some expansion of finance. And your expansion of credit, that's what creates this new purchasing power. And it goes in, you know, it's going to buy an asset. That asset price goes up, and the higher asset price entices more people to come in and leverage that asset. So it's self-reinforcing, and as I said at the end, it's unsustainable. This is a bubble in finance, right? It's, we can say Bitcoin, we can say tech stocks, but those are almost like a consequence of this bubble overall in finance, and that's global finance. Greenspan was key to this, and I talked about the 87 stock market crash, and also this promise of liquidity, this assurance, this guarantee of underlying liquidity. You mentioned derivatives. Derivatives are key to this because derivatives, basically that market functions on this assumption of liquid and continuous markets. Because a lot of the people that write market insurance, they don't, it's not really insurance. They don't set reserves to the side for when there's a market problem and they can pay, you know, like you would a casualty loss on an auto accident. That's an insurable event. Market events are not random. They're not independent. They're really not insurable. So whoever writes this flood insurance, they plan one way or the other to offload this risk to someone else. They plan if they have to hedge their market risk that they've written, they're going to go out and dynamically hedge their risk, which basically means selling into a down market. Well, that's fine. It works great as long as everyone assumes the markets will always be liquid. So we have this myth that all this market insurance is really real. And I think this market insurance, this overall market insurance marketplace is key to the whole world wanting to take a lot of risk. I come back also to this flaw in understanding that Greenspan had. And he used to say, well, you can't have a national real estate bubble because real estate markets are local. You can have local bubbles, but you're not going to have a national real estate bubble. And my response back then was, I'm sorry, the issue is a national bubble in mortgage finance. That's why I never called it the housing bubble. It was the mortgage finance bubble. And that was feeding mispriced mortgage credit, unlimited mispriced mortgage credit throughout the whole system. Okay, that's why it was a national, in many ways, an international bubble. And when you have these fundamental mispricings of unlimited finance globally, that's how you get these distortions. And I've also argued, Chris, that it's a very interesting dynamic. The more systemic a bubble, the less obvious it is. The tech bubble in the late 90s, that was pretty conspicuous, right? But when the bubble burst, it was not isolated, but it was relatively contained within the technology sector, so it didn't have devastating impact on the whole economy. The mortgage finance bubble, which was much more systemic, most people didn't see it. In hindsight, they say they saw it, but they didn't at the time, I can assure you. But it was much more deeply systemic. This one is so deeply systemic, people just don't see it, because basically we're inflating, distorting all the markets, so nothing looks extremely unreasonable to most people. But in the end of the day, the finance is deeply unsound and unsustainable, I would argue.
Now, one of my favorite current statistics for that is junk debt in Europe, which is now, according to a Financial Times article from a few days ago, reportedly trading at or just below a 2% yield. This is for junk debt. And for people who don't know what that is, this is debt that's been issued by companies whose prospects are particularly poor. They've got some issues, and this would be the equivalent of your totally unreliable drunk Uncle Vinny, you know, who's never paid a dime back in his life, lending him more money. Your chance of getting it back, not good. So these are really poor prospect companies trading at 2% with a 10-year U.S. Treasury yield at 2.3%, roughly. I don't know exactly where it is at this moment, but call it, you know, 0.3% higher than junk debt in Europe that now have an implied default rate of less than zero. That means the market has priced European junk debt, your drunk uncle, and has said he has a less than zero chance of not paying you back. Absolutely astonishing. What are the chances, Doug, that there are some losses, somehow some malinvestment baked into that statistic?
Well, there will be losses. And of the global bubble, I think European debt is about the most conspicuous. And yeah, the junk debt, European junk debt at 2%. Why is it at 2%? Because the ECB is buying large amounts of corporate debt. The ECB has kept rates either a zero or negative. The perception is that the ECB will keep those markets liquid. So with that perception, why not try to get a little higher yield? I would argue, though, Italy at 1.7% today yield, 10-year Italian bonds. Italy rapidly approaching 135% government debt to GDP. Yeah. That debt will not get paid back, but yet the market will hold that debt at 1.7. And I think this is debt that traded over 7% yield back in 2011, 2012. And here it is today at 1.7. I mean, just a gross mispricing of a huge debt market. Italian debt is, you know, there's over $1 trillion of Italian debt out there. So yeah, it's staggering the excesses that have unfolded in European debt across the board. And that's junk and sovereign.
Now, Doug, I pick up your excellent writings at creditbubblebulletin.blogspot.com. I'm looking here at one of your weekly commentaries from Saturday, November 4th. Opening line, I want you to explain this to people. You say, of the diverse strains of inflation, asset inflation is by far the most dangerous. Why is that?
Yeah, and I have to credit the great German economist, Dr. Kurt Rischebacher, for this analysis. I had the good fortune, I started reading Dr. Rischebacher's monthly newsletter back in 1990, fell in love with the quality of his analysis, and was fortunate to help him with his newsletter for, I think, 5 years. It, you know, began back in,
wow, what
in
a,
the
that's
90s.
Great.
Yeah, that was, he was just a great, a brilliant guy, a great thinker of Austrian economics. And he talked about this a lot where, okay, you get back to credit. Credit is key. So if you can see an expansion of credit, that's an expansion of purchasing power, then it's a matter of trying to understand where that purchasing power is going, what the impact of it is, and what the inevitable consequences are of that credit inflation. And what he argued, and I agree completely, is that consumer price inflation, that's one of many different types of inflation, right? You can have an inflation in consumer prices. You can have an inflation, obviously, in asset prices. You can have, if you have too much credit, excess purchasing power, you can have trade deficits, current account deficits. You can have an investment boom. You can have many variations of credit inflation. And what he said was, what he believed was that consumer price inflation was probably the least dangerous of those because it was the most easy to deal with. There's a constituency out there that can recognize consumer price inflation and say, wait, we don't want to have too much inflation. So they demand that the central banks tighten. Let's say like we saw with Volcker and the Volcker Fed, where they put the screws to the economy to get those inflationary biases wrung out of the economy. Well, Dr. Rishabhasher and I certainly argue today that asset inflation is much more dangerous because there's no constituency. Indeed, people love asset inflation. Who is complaining about asset inflation today? There was some complaints after the asset bubbles burst in 2008, 2009, but after people start to make money in the markets, they forget about that. Just bring on more asset inflation. And this type of asset inflation, not only is it self-reinforcing, it leads to significant distortions in investment. And if you allow this inflation for too long, you're going to have deep distortions in the economic structure. Those are very dangerous, as we learned not that many years ago and as we've forgotten. But that's why asset inflation is so dangerous, because no one will rein it in, and the inevitable structural impact it can be negative and take years to rectify.
We now know that the European Central Bank intervened along with the Bank of Japan in January of 2016, early February, to help prevent a market decline from going any further. And we also saw a very odd and, for me, difficult to reconcile blast higher after the surprise Trump election. The Dow was off 1,000 points by, 2:30 in the morning, and then by open, it was almost green again. How likely is it in your mind that there was some help provided to falling markets there in the early Wednesday morning after the Trump surprise? More broadly, do you believe that these central banks are so scared of the Franken markets they've created that they are now intervening covertly as well as overtly?
Wouldn't surprise me. My analysis, I kind of ignore for the most part the covert aspect of mm-hmm. this and focus on what they tell us they're going to do. But if they're going to tell us that they're going to buy trillions of dollars worth of debt, create trillions of dollars of money, create negative interest rates, assure the markets that they're backstopping them, I don't know why they wouldn't act covertly when they think it's necessary. I don't know if they did after the election. After the election, there was certainly a major short squeeze, a big unwind of derivatives when it became obvious that the markets were not going to tank after the election. And, so I can see, market forces that could also lead to that type of a market dislocation and a melt-up. But nothing would surprise me at this point. I assume over the years they've often intervened to stabilize the markets, because this is a very unstable financial structure. It's interesting these days, the VIX is so low. Those are the volatility indexes are so low. The assumption is the markets are extremely stable. But I think it is the markets are so unstable, the central banks have had to come in with extraordinary markets to convince everyone they're stable, which is part of this misperception that's led to the very dangerous bubble that we see today.
Well, you mentioned the things we do know. So we do know that the Japanese central bank has been buying ETFs of Japanese stock shares and doing it preferentially on days when the markets were declining. So that's overt at this point in time. And of course, the Swiss National Bank overtly buying U.S. equities, particularly the large issues. So that's what we know about. And then, of course, there's things we have to sort of wonder about, like after Superstorm Sandy is the justification. The New York Fed, which has a very large trading desk operation, which I'd love to see audited just to find out. They said, hey, we didn't like, how risky it seemed after Sandy proved that, things can happen. So we've decided to move our trading desk somewhere. Coincidentally, it's in Aurora, Illinois now, which is where, for those who know, the Chicago Mercantile Exchange servers are located, where some of the most highly levered trades exist. that can help do things like drive VIX down or prop, buy futures in other highly levered products at key moments if you wanted to do that. But purely coincidental, we're being led to believe that the Fed moved its trading operation there. And as well, we know that the Chicago Mercantile Exchange has a central bank in preferred buyer program because they're such heavy customers that they've offered them some of the best volume discounts. But Doug, I haven't found a single balance sheet of a single central bank anywhere that will admit to having any of these products anywhere in its portfolio, yet they're some of the most heavy buyers. So call that covert, it's half overt. I don't really know. I'm squinting at it. I'm just saying, look, I think these central, and honestly doesn't matter to me because I think that they fail. It's just the question of how spectacularly do they fail in these efforts. What matters to me is that it indicates to me that I think these central banks are actually afraid of the very conditions that they've created for themselves. And my overt data for this is, by the numbers, when you look at corporate earnings, when you look at the acceleration in certain things, when you look at in certain economic components, when you look at trade, when you look at growth isn't great, it's not bad. When you look at unemployment, listen, Doug, by the numbers, not bad. But when we wander over and look at the amount of central bank stimulus still pouring into these markets, well over $100 billion a month still, that's an emergency. So which is it? Is everything okay? Or is it an emergency? I think the central banks are acting like they're scared.
Right. I agree completely. And to me, it gets back, and you mentioned it earlier in the conversation, that the problem with discretionary monetary management, with discretionary central banking, is that one mistake leads to a bigger mistake. And this is actually a debate that goes back, 150 years back to Britain. And we've seen that repeatedly, where we have market distortions that are induced by the central bankers that lead to a bubble, and then you have a collapse, and then only deeper government involvement. And we're at the point now where I think they're very fearful of backing off whatsoever. You know, they talk interest rate normalization, but we're not even close to that. The ECB started with their QE program in 2012, and here we are. They're still going to be injecting more liquidity into the markets in 2018. Extremely hesitant to back away at all from QE. If everything was stable, I think the central banks would be much more willing to actually move towards normalization. So I don't think for a minute that they believe that finance is stable. I think they know they're dealing with a bubble. I think they're hoping that they can inflate, that this inflation dynamic can, they can grow their way out of this fragility. But that's the problem with the bubble. You can't grow your way out of it. The bubble just gets bigger. They want to inflate this consumer price index to grow our way out of debt and asset price bubbles. Well, all they do is increase the size of the bubble in the asset markets and the underlying distortions in the real economy. So especially late in the bubble, it's very dangerous because bubbles take on a life of their own. We're seeing it today in Bitcoin. We're seeing it in dramatic price moves in security. That's fixed income, equity. So they're trapped right now. And I think that explains a lot of why they've been so hesitant to try to get back to a more normal monetary environment. And now they're to the point where I think they just fear doing anything dramatic. And at this stage in the bubble, the only way to rein it in is doing something dramatic, force pain on speculators, force pain on those that are leveraged, and start the cleansing process to get a more stable monetary backdrop. And Chris, while I'm rambling here, I wanted to mention China. We haven't mentioned China yet.
Oh, please. It's on my question list here, so let's go.
Sure. China's key to this global bubble. It's historic what's going on in China. They may have $4 trillion of system credit growth this year, wow, which surpasses, the U.S. in the height of our mortgage finance bubble. This bubble got completely away from them. And today, I think, especially after the recent Communist Party Congress, that they have decided to try to rein in some of the excess, try to slow overall credit growth. And I think the consequences, the ramifications are profound. Of course, everyone at this point believes that Chinese won't the Chinese officials won't take any dramatic moves and won't burst their bubble. But I think things are changing in China, where they recognize belatedly the seriousness of their problem. And I think that will be an unfolding story for 2018. And I think there are consequences for you know, certainly the emerging markets and for global finance and global economics more generally, because that bubble is, it's incredible what's unfolded in China.
And this party congress, for people listening, every 5 years, China has a fairly large, this is their equivalent of the presidential election cycle. And this is where party politics get consolidated, power gets redistributed. President Xi, X-I-G, he really came out a clear winner, a very, very dominant position. He's got a lot of help in key positions. It really looks to me from the outside, not being a super astute observer of Chinese politics, but it looks like he's got a good grasp and command of the leadership there. And I wasn't expecting, Doug, anything to really happen credit-wise. I was expecting stability in their stock market leading up to that party congress, which happened mid-October. Now that things seem to have sort of consolidated, the powers certainly seems to be in place. Now, I think, would be the time to expect to see what they're going to do, if anything, to rein in this bubble. And I think President Xi, very smart man, a lot of very clever people as well surrounding him. They have to know that trying to let the steam out of a bubble is a better consequence for them politically than to allow it to burst on its own. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah, that's right. And they claimed for years that they had studied and learned from the Japanese experience. And I think they thought that they had, and they thought they had their bubble under control. But at the end of the day, it got away from them. They tried a series of timid measures over years to lean against the wind, to try to rein in, especially, you know, their housing bubble, which is really an apartment bubble. But the underlying finance and the mispricing of finance that was a global phenomenon, that was more than compensated for their tightening measures. And the real estate bubble basically went completely out of control. Their credit growth went completely out of control. And now I think they're finally deciding we're gonna have to bite the bullet and try to get this under control. Again, they're going to try to do it gradually, but they've already targeted over the last just two, three weeks. The shadow banking area, which is key. They're targeting the wealth management products, where there's a real misperception that Beijing will ensure that everybody's whole on their investments. So throughout China, the average person gets on the internet and sends in their savings to these wealth management vehicles to get 6-7%, believing that their government will never allow them to lose money. And that has led to this, you know, hundreds of billions, even trillions into high risk corporate credit in China, risky local government debt for the developers, indirectly into mortgage debt. And I think they recognize that this is, this is unsound, and, that they're going to try to rein it in. It's not going to go smoothly. They're real estate markets are so mispriced. There's trillions of dollars of mispriced credit. But I think the process has started, and everyone globally is so complacent now, just believing that, that China will never allow a burst into their bubble, that they're not following developments in China as closely as they should. Here in the U.S., everyone just follows every headline with tax legislation and tax cuts, and at this point totally disregards China, and I think that's a mistake.
I agree, and there's a component here as well, which is just math, whether the government will or will not allow or will backstop something. Steve Keen, the economist, has shown very clearly, very small spreadsheet, takes a couple of columns and a few rows to figure out that when you're injecting credit into an economy, it will grow, and the growth will be a function of its organic growth that was there anyway, plus the stimulative effect of the credit. And so even a flattening of credit growth is GDP negative. But let's say you said, wow, $4 trillion, that exceeds the height of the United States credit growth. And this is in an economy that's smaller on a percentage on an aggregate basis. So on a percentage basis, that's a really big, big increase. So let's just say it's something like 30%. Even if They only grow credit by 20% next year, and it was 30% last year. That's negative for the overall growth in the economy, and that's not something you can legislate away. I don't care how authoritarian or totalitarian your government is. I don't care what laws you pass. That has an impact all its own. But to your point, I think the really critical part here is you can't put that much credit into an economy that size without some of it going into hopelessly unproductive works. It will never be paid back. That capital has been betrayed. It seems to me that's just like one of the features of bubbles is you create too much credit and it gets betrayed. Is that fair?
Yeah, that's fair. Very accurate. And I'll try not to confuse everyone, but I think this is an important point. At the end of the credit cycle, and I call it the terminal phase, where the system essentially self-destructs, and we can throw out Japan. Japan did incredible things rebuilding their economy over several decades and basically destroyed their credit system over about 3.5 years in this terminal phase of their bubble. At the terminal phase, and we can think subprime, we can think U.S. mortgage credit during the mortgage finance bubble, you have this rapid growth of credit. And at the end of the cycle, this credit, is the quality deteriorates very quickly, right? You're financing poor projects. You're financing overpriced real estate, right? So you have this hypothetical chart of systemic risk that goes parabolic because you're increasing credit rapidly, of rapidly deteriorating credit quality. So that's what they have in China. Of this $4 trillion of credit, I mean, half of it or more likely can just be bad credit. It's financing overpriced real estate. It's financing uneconomic enterprises. It's financing fraud, right? All kinds of things. It's servicing the debt of highly leveraged institutions or companies that will not be able to pay this money back. So yes, credit does crazy things at the end of the cycle, and it leads to a destruction of the credit worthiness of that finance, along with the economic imbalances and maladjustment below the surface, and all of them come back to haunt because at some point you can't continue to create. Is China going to create $5 trillion of new credit next year? How much of that $5 trillion is going to be bad credit? So there's really no way around this, right? You're just making the problem worse and dramatically worse late in the cycle. That is the problem. That's what's not recognized by central bankers or officials in China.
There's only one question to resolve at the end of a long credit cycle, and that's who's going to eat the losses? That's the way I think of it. As we look at this and you say that, you know, we're at this point in this bubble where certainly, you know, the central bankers don't want to risk bursting it. They don't want to be the ones. Nobody really wants to be the one to step up and say, you know, maybe we should stop this at this point. It makes me think of the von Mises quote. You know, there's really, at the end of a credit expansion, your choices include voluntarily abandoning it, or risking a collapse of the currency system involved. But this is now a global system. It's a global bubble. What's our reference currency at this particular point in time? So two questions in that for you, Doug. First, what concludes this long credit cycle? How does this sort of end if nobody's willing to end it? And secondarily, let's talk about gold in this context, because I'm losing hope here. It just gets clubbed like a baby seal constantly in the U.S. markets in particular. It seems not to have had its usual signaling characteristics available to it since 2011, coincident with QE3, very odd moment there again for those who think like I do. But here we are. What ends this credit bubble, and what's the role of gold, if any, as we come through it?
Sure. I'll give that a try. Those are tough questions. I always prefer easy questions, but those are tough. Part of the reason I say this is the granddaddy of all bubbles, this is will end a long cycle, is that the bubble has gone to the heart of money and credit. It's gone to sovereign debt. It's gone to government debt and central bank credit. So there'll be no way out. We're not going to get enough private credit growth to reflate when this bubble bursts. It's going to have to come from central bank credit. It's going to have to come from sovereign debt. Markets are fine with that. They as long as sovereign or as long as both of those grow, they're okay, because that seems to support the markets. At the end of the day, I think what will shock people when this bubble bursts, and who knows what the catalyst will be, how far central banks have to expand their balance sheet just to accommodate the deleveraging in the system. So it's not really going to add new liquidity to the market. It's just going to allow the transfer of leverage positions from the leverage players onto central bank balance sheets. So I think when you get to that point, when the market sees that issue, I think there's going to be fear of long-term financial instruments. I think there'll be rising yields. Sovereign yields don't have much further to drop at this point. So that's when things become problematic, I think, is when central banks begin aggressively expanding their balance sheets, yet the bond markets are not happy about it. And then the central banks will finally have to decide if they want to continue to inflate their balance sheets or if they're going to focus on trying to keep market yields down. Very, very difficult situation for central bankers when it unfolds. Bubbles are all about a redistribution and destruction of wealth. That's why we're seeing, you know, a lot of social stress here in the U.S. is these bubbles have redistributed wealth. I fear the global bubble, we're redistributing wealth globally. So I fear for the geopolitical landscape. Geopolitical could easily be a catalyst for bursting the global bubble. I hope this doesn't end in war. That's not something I focus a lot on, but it would almost seem inevitable to me that there'll be conflicts after this bubble bursts. As far as gold, I'm a big fan, believer of gold. Let's feel kind of stupid because I was listening to an analysis on Bloomberg just the other day saying there's a lot of similarities between Bitcoin and gold. And I think the pundit was referring to, you know, kind of a safe haven function of both. I guess you can buy Bitcoin and be away from the banks and everything else. But to me, gold and Bitcoin could not be more different. One has backing, one doesn't. One's been a proven store of value for a long, long time. One, I think, is a flash in the pan bubble. So I think today part of the drag on gold is why buy gold if you can buy Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies or bonds or whatever else. But I think at the end of the day, those will not be a very good store of value, store of wealth. I think gold will. And when the bubble starts to burst, I expect gold to do extremely well. I'm not discouraged on gold. I think it'll do fine.
All right. I share that view. And of course, the long sweep of bubbles bursting is that credit is a claim on wealth. Real wealth is real stuff. So a point I like to make to audiences a lot is when you look at the Weimar inflation, very famous because people have in their minds a picture of somebody wheelbarrowing a big stack of bound banknotes to buy a loaf of bread or shoveling them into the furnace. So we understand that. And you read these books that are written about it and they talk about a wealth destruction, but it's not true. The claims on wealth got destroyed, but the real wealth stayed there. Just as many hotels before and after, just as many arable acres of farmland, just as many factories. Who owned them? Now that changed. So I call it a wealth transfer, not a wealth destruction. You're remarking on that our social unrest in the United States is due to the fact that the Federal Reserve is not a wealth-creating machine. They are a redistribution engine. And they've taken from the many to give to the few. They've punished savers, pensions, anybody who, retirees, the elderly, the young. I mean, they've really thrown a pretty... I mean, if this was a Disney movie, they are Cruella de Vil in this story. Really, it's just not good. So, Doug, stepping outside of economics and finance purely, just for a moment, where and how do you think the idea of natural limits, how do those factor into your thinking? And I'm thinking of ecological limits, like there's only so much soil with so many macro and micronutrients in it, and the fact that fossil fuels are finite, and those represent, of course, the source of so much of our wealth over the past 150 years. Where do you place those sort of things that are external to the finance and economic system, but really central to it when you get right down to it?
Yeah, and I might take just a little bit of a different angle on this. In this era here, and I'm surprised people don't refer to a new paradigm again, a new era again, because it reminds me a lot of the 1990s. We're seeing, you know, profound innovation, technological innovation, and it's easy to get captivated by this. And and what the alternative energy can do. But at the end of the day, I think there isn't enough focus on the soundness of money, the soundness of finance. And right now there's this view that we can finance any type of alternative energy. We can finance any type of new technology. There's an arms race going on in so many areas. And that becomes very dangerous during the late stage of the bubble period, because I think a lot of this, as exciting as it is, it will prove uneconomic when the bubble bursts and when there's a realization that finance is unstable. So I often say that during periods of extraordinary innovation, that's when you need to refocus on finance, refocus on sound money. And unfortunately today there is none of that whatsoever. And we're seeing in China with the ecological damage that's unfolding in China when you have $1.5 trillion of people with basically free money and investment, and that financial investment and real investment in the economy, that the damage that can be done to our planet in these type of booms, it really makes me think that there's so much and so many reasons to get back to a focus on sound money and finance. So that's kind of my focus in this environment is, a lot of unfortunate things are happening because of the financial backdrop.
Yeah, and my analysis is that, you know, there are a lot of different money systems. Sound money is very different from credit-based fiat money, where fiat money has at its heart this idea that you can expand exponentially infinitely. There's just no end to anything. You know, it's just, we'll just keep compounding forever. And that's the model. And of course, you look at anything like a CBO projection of economic growth. By the year 2070, I think they have the United States economy as large as the entire world's economy right now. Simple me goes, where's the coal for that? Where's the natural gas? Where's the oil? Where's the steel? Where's the gallium? Where's the fish? Where's the whatever, right? And so I think we're coming out of a period where humans basically developed systems when the world seemed infinite, but it's clearly not anymore. And China's running up against those limits with its however many 1.3 to 1.5 billion people, whatever they've got. It's funny, their spread and their population is the entire population of the United States. So we're a rounding error in Chinese terms. So when I look at all of that, it feels like that's really the thing under this that's being not looked at, is that our entire system of money as it's being practiced is founded on a premise that may or may not, you know, have a giant glaring error sort of at its heart, which is you can't grow forever. You have to figure out how not to grow, but we have a financial system that's geared, labored, implemented, built around, and unfortunately woven into our political systems in a way that says we can't do anything other than what we've been doing, has to stay the same. And the central banks have really been the guardians of the status quo, when patently the status quo is no longer serving the majority of the people in this country, the United States, and elsewhere. So to me, that's sort of like the most grievous sin that the central banks have been committing, is failing to act, to think appropriately about their role and being appropriate guardians of both the present and the future. They've really been guardians of the past. And I think that's just an unforgivable sin in many respects. So we'll see how that all plays out. Doug, thank you so much for your time today. That's all the time we have, unfortunately. I could talk to you forever. Everybody, we've been talking with Doug Noland. You can find him at creditbubblebulletin.blogspot.com. Doug, any other ways that people can follow your work more closely?
Yeah, you had mentioned my blog, and it's easy. You can just search my name to get to my blog. I also post at McIlvaney.com. So it's out there. On a weekly basis, I do the best I can to chronicle the bubble. I'll keep doing it.
Well, fantastic. Thank you for doing that. It's been absolutely magnificent and absolutely important work that for me to follow, because I think you've, you know, been channeling all the great teachers you've had and carrying on that great tradition of using sound thinking and actual data. So thank you for that work, and I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me on, Chris. It was a real pleasure chatting with you today. Thank you.